These next two probably need little introduction. Our Hooley Records was founded 45 years ago. I see Mr. Strackwood's counting over there. Put out its first album recorded not very far from here in Navasota, Texas, a man named Mance Lipscomb. Since that time has been at the forefront of ethnic and vernacular recording in American, especially in Texas. Here to discuss the ambitious Frontera collection, to put it mildly, ambitious, are Hooley Records, Chris Strackwitz and Tom Diamant.
Hello, is our AV guy here?
Yes, what do you
need? The projector put on.
Well, while they turn things on, maybe some of you are not familiar with the whole idea of the Frontera Collection, is that I started a foundation, it's about 6-7 years ago, called the Arhuli Foundation, because I remember talking to Mo Ash of Folkways Records, and he said, Chris, you know, we all have to think of what's going to happen to all the stuff that we collect when we depart this wonderful place. And so my lawyer also said, listen, this Mexican collection is pretty unique because there's a lot of one-of-a-kind items in there, quite a lot. And so he said, start a foundation. That's the thing to do these days. And so that's how it all started. And then we had Professor Guillermo Hernandez, who's been a longtime friend of ours at UCLA. He spoke with Los Tigres del Norte, the biggest conjunto in this field, and they were just in a very wealthy mood, and they said, listen, we're very impressed about UCLA studying our material as literature, and they were just really knocked out by the whole concept that any university is going to pay attention to what was considered by most academics commercial or low class or whatever you want to call it. And so he persuaded them to start a foundation, and they were very keen to give money to UCLA because they didn't want to give it directly to us because that would not be as prestigious. And so the unfortunate thing is that universities can't give grants to another outfit. They can only farm out, you know, and that wouldn't help us with the IRS at all. So we got involved with another group called the Fund for Folk Culture. So the money comes from Los Tigres to UCLA to the Fund for Folk Culture in New Mexico to the Arhuli Foundation. And we've been doing this now for 4 years or so. And we're almost finished with the 78. So anyway, here's Tom to introduce the noodle to you.
Well, Chris started this collection late 50s. Is that when you started collecting it? Something like that. Currently, it holds around 15,078 RPMs. It used to hold 20,045s, but we just bought another 5,000 that we're sort of shuffling through to see what we're going to keep. A whole bunch of LPs, cassettes, and CDs. The 78 seemed to be the most fragile at the time. These wonderful little chains are supposed to hold them on the shelves in case of an earthquake. We are between two major fault lines. It did concern us about preservation. That was our first concern, was preservation. But as we started talking to UCLA, access seemed to be another consideration. Here are the 45s, which can jump off the shelves because hopefully they're unbreakable. So we decided that the best thing to do was to make a digital archive for UCLA. Oh, here's pretty pictures of what's some of the labels that are in the archive of the 78s. We first scan the label. This way we get a digital image of the label. We scan a good part of the black surface around it so that we can pick up any matrix numbers that's in there. We do a 300 DPI scan of it. We also have a database that we've created from all the information on the label, plus information that we've found from other sources, including Dick Spotswood's discography of ethnic music. And we've added that to the discography for the metadata. We clean the record using our Keith Monk record cleaner. It sucks up the dirt quite nicely, unless it's got what Chris calls a Texas sludge or grime, in which case we just run it under, we take it into the kitchen, turn on the faucet, put the Joy soap on it, and scrub that thing until it's nice and clean, trying not to wet the label too much, and that might disturb some people hearing that, but the toughest stuff in the world are 78s as long as you don't drop them. Here's a lovely blue Columbia that we're playing to transfer it. Somebody mentioned A to D converters. We use a Prism Dream, which is a very nice A to D converter. It's also the most expensive item that we purchased for this whole project. While we're, and I'm running through this really quickly because I want Chris to talk about the Texas label. So if you have more, a lot of questions about this, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. Antonio, who is fluent in Spanish, listens to the songs and writes down keywords. If it's about revolution, murder, labor, jealousy, horses, whatever, we've got a whole list of keywords so that researchers can then search the collection using keywords as they're trying to find items. So we've got a discography with keywords, a label scan. The sound recordings are 24-bit, 96 kilohertz. They're broadcast waves. We throw all the metadata into the broadcast wave header. And then we put it on a DVD. We make two copies of the DVD. One we store, one we send down to UCLA. They put it on their big server. Now, we have the luxury, everybody says, well, DVDs, how long do they last? We do have the luxury of having UCLA have it on their server, so if our DVDs do disintegrate, there is a backup. How long do they last? I can tell you the ones we made 4 years ago still work. Somebody asked about which ones people are using. We're using Verbatim. Those were the ones when we started. They're DVD-Rs. They seem to work well. They used to be 2X. Now we're using 8X. We have a 16X burner, but we don't go that fast because we don't believe in it. Let me run you through. Now we're embarking at the same time, simultaneously, of digitizing our photo archive, which Chris donated to the foundation. Let me quickly run through how our database works. And for that, I got to change programs here. And I don't have a mouse. Where's my mouse? There it is. Oh, I can't see. So we have discography, we have artist bios, we have photo galleries, lyrics, record label histories, and we actually have one video. You can do a search. Let's do a search on labor. Ooh, I can't see. Very well. Okay, here we go. Under the keywords, and we get all of these songs are about labor. We can do it even tighter. We can say migrant labor. Ooh. Oh, you have to be able to type in the dark to do this. Nah. Oh, all right. Well, I'm just looking for migrant. Let's see what it comes up with. So we get all these songs. Let's see, where's the one I wanted to find? I don't know whether it's going to be easier to find. Oh, we can sort by all these different ways. I sorted by this way so that I can find the one I wanted to hear. Lalo Guerrero just passed away, so I thought we'd bring up this one. It's on the Colony label. You can zoom in, do that. You can play it. We slate each recording, since these are individual files.
Colony 115-A, matrix number DI-360, El Barzón, Lalo Guerrero.
So in case the file is without the discography, people can... Lalo just passed away a week or two ago, a great loss for the...
Esas tierras del rincón.
And as usual, it's a parody on migrant labor. We're doing this great photo archive now that we're getting into with all these varieties of photos. And let's see. Let's look for Luis Arcos. Luis Arcos, he was a gentleman who murdered three people, and somehow that was something that people really wanted to write songs about. So you can dial him up. There's a picture of him. You can click on this little thing, find the recordings. Here are all the recordings about Los Arcos. You can see there are quite a few. Once again, oh, it's another beautiful blue color. I love these color of the blue.
No, don't use this one. That's okay.
You know, and it's just one. We're tying in artist bios. This is by Los Hermanos Chavarria. We don't have a picture of the two of them together. That's pretty much how it works. You can listen, you can view, you can read lyrics. We have label graphics. We have all these all these cool 78 sleeves. We are now digitizing them. We don't, of course, keep them in these. We keep them in archival sleeves, but these sleeves show us that even from the get-go, people were selling to the Spanish language crowd because the sleeves are written in Spanish. And pardon?
That one's not of that era.
That one is not of that era because the way the database is set up, it chooses just one from that era. I mean, you know.
That's an acoustic.
You know, we can go through them one by one here, and you can choose the era that you want for the Columbia, or the ones that the mouse chewed. Okay. Is this the right one?
That one's pretty close, yeah.
But it just shows you, once you digitize something, how it's just, you know, really great it can be. So that is what we're doing. We've digitized around 25,000 individual sides. We're deep into the victors right now. We've done it alphabetically, so we're in the V's. There are quite a few victors. We hope to be done by May. We've just gotten a $40,000 grant from the Grammy Foundation to start digitizing the 45s, which are going to be really interesting because that's the era when anybody with $250 could put out a 45, and a lot of topical songs are involved in that. So we're very much interested in doing that. And then, let's go over to here. Whoops. UCLA has put this all up on a website. There is the address. It's on their digital library. If you do a search for the UCLA Digital Library, you can find it. They have a slightly different interface. They have a history of it. It's bilingual, which is something we really insisted on having done. You can do a search. You can listen anywhere in the world for a 60-second clip because of copyright issues that they haven't quite figured out. You can listen to 60 seconds. If you dial in from the UCLA domain, you can listen to the entire item. They have all of our metadata put in there. They've done a beautiful job of setting up the labels. They tweak our labels a little bit to make them pop out at you. And that is basically what's going on with the Frontera collection. I have the entire collection on this computer. We take the WAVE files and we turn them into MP3s. We take the label scans and turn them into JPEGs, and they all fit on a laptop or your iPod if you have that. When we're done, that's what I'm thinking, an iPod filled with 30,000 songs from the Frontera collection. But we're here also to talk about Texas record labels. Here are some of them. There are many, many of them. And now Chris Strachwitz will take it over.
Thank you, Tom.
And
I really appreciate Tom's devotion to this, because I don't think you were really into Mexican music all that much when you started, but he was certainly into Bob Wills and Texas music anyway. And he's so computer savvy, which I'm the total opposite. And I just swear at and yell, "Tom, what can I do?" And he saves me. I also want to welcome my good friend, Professor Jaime Nikolopoulos, who I think wandered in the back somewhere, who is an expert on the corridos, who teaches here at the University of Texas at Austin in the Spanish and Portuguese department. And he, I think, anyway, you'll have a chance to meet him afterwards if you're interested in it. He also teaches a course in corridos, which, of course, are there. Their ballads, the topical ballads, and I can't go into all those details, but we're going to start dealing with four labels, because two of them were pretty big ones from the Rio Grande Valley. The first one is Ideal Records, Ideal Records in English, And they were the very first ones, started in 1946, literally, as somebody already mentioned earlier today, in the kitchen of Mr. Marroquin, who was married to Carmen, and her sister is Laura. So he always appreciated the duet of the two sisters, Carmen y Laura. And they were sort of like the Andrews sisters, and they sang English, Spanish, everything, but and in every style possible. So they started with that. At that time, they didn't have their own label. They farmed them out to the Four Star label in Pasadena, which was a up and starting country label, but they were obviously supplying custom service to people who needed pressing, and they heard about this label, and so they said, will you press these records for us? And so the very first ones produced by Mr. Marroquin in Alice, Texas, came out on the Four Star label. They started a Spanish series for the material. And then Mr. Betancourt, who was a businessman in Brownsville, said, this guy seems to be doing pretty good with his little funky selling there. Maybe I ought to get together with him and we'll start our own company here. And that's what happened. So Ideal Records was started very soon thereafter. And from then on, the material was pressed on the Ideal or Ideal record label. I don't think, oh yeah, here it is in the lower corner.
Yeah, let's run the thing on Ideal now.
Okay, so we're going to hear a little bit of some of the things recorded for Ideal. This is their first, the house musician was Narciso Martinez, who became already famous in the 30s as the accordion player. He literally set the pace for all future accordionists from this area, because he was like Lonnie Johnson or T-Bone Walker to the blues guitar. He was the inventor, literally, of playing the accordion in this particular style. And he backed up, of course. Oh, wait a minute. On the first records, they had a different accordionist. Anyway. No, that's him on the right. That's the two sisters singing, Carmen y Laura. E stands for and in Spanish. Mr. Marroquin, the husband of Carmen, he was in the jukebox business. When he discovered during the war that he couldn't get any more records because the majors stopped producing them, that's how he came up with the idea of starting his own record company. This apparently was one of the first couples on the other side of the border to put this music on the radio. They were broadcasting out of Nuevo Laredo. Became extraordinarily popular throughout both sides of the border. This is the major orchestra whose idol was Xavier Cugat, but he knew where his bread and butter was, and so he formed a combination of sort of swing, Mexican orchestra music, and he introduced the accordion into it, which became a huge hit. Okay. This is a much more middle-class type music, the bolero. I would compare it to what Billie Holiday did for jazz, Chelo Silva did for this music. She became extraordinarily popular on this side, but then really became big because Columbia Records from Mexico started recording her after she began on Ideal, then went to Falcon Records, and eventually recorded. Of course, Columbia had the distribution. And she was a tough cookie. She told us, I had the fortune to interview her when she was still alive. She once literally stopped the fight at a joint. She busted up these two guys who had knives on each other. the wonderful alto saxophonist, Pedro Lopez. This is a much more Tejano type orchestra in contrast to Beto Villa, who mixed it. This is very, very much Tejano sound.
Si me emborracho no es que traiga sentimiento, sino de gusto que ya tienes nuevo amor.
He only died very recently too, great guy. He was puro indio, he was a solid Indian, was very proud of it. That's it for a little survey of the Ideal label, and I can go, of course, I happened to be in the right place at the right time when I heard that the... He was actually, I think, the son-in-law. He married one of the relatives. I forgot how it goes. Mr. Marroquin died, and Mr. Betancourt, actually, since he was the money man behind it, he was actually the one who owned the material. And the guy who worked for him, it became known to me, I forgot exactly how, saying they were trying to sell what was left of the material. And so I took a dream trip down there to Brownsville. And he basically said, well, all we have is the LPs that we produced in the 60s from this material. And I think there were about 35 or 37 of LPs. And I was expecting to find those. But, of course, I knew they had tons of 78s. And when I got there, you know, he said, well, here are all the tapes for the LPs. And then I said, well, what's in that back room there? Oh, that's where the press is. That's where we used to press them at, towards the end. We had our own press there. And as I walked in there, I saw these shelves filled with 10-inch boxes. And I said, what's in those? Well, they were full of Ideal 78s and test pressings. And I said, oh, wow. Well, he said, if they're Ideal material, they're yours, since I paid him his requested sum that he wanted for the thing. And, oh, boy, he was collector freak me, all these test pressings, because they were really quiet. They were pressed on vinyl on one side, and he had kept them all. They had kept everything because the first, I think, 200 or 300, even more, I think, they were all cut on acetates originally. And then the acetates were sent to the processing plant. Of course, the master was made from that, and then a mother and so forth, and the stamper. And they actually had test pressings made of all of them. Mr. Marroquin wanted to make sure they were loud enough and they didn't skip and all that. And he kept them. So I had a... And then, as I started walking out, there was another sort of a mezzanine in the place, and there were all these 7-inch tape reels. And I said, what are those? Well, those are some of the singles of, you know, that we still have tapes on. I said, oh, good. And so literally, almost from the end of the test pressings, from, you know, when they start using tape, almost all of those were also still there. And so I just had a field day. And I don't know how I really fell so much in love with this music. But once you meet the people and the whole combination and that's intriguing material that's on them, especially these corridos, which tell you it's the richest history, I think, of any American music. Maybe you can't call it American, but then Mexico is in the Americas. And they are just as much on this side of the border, actually some of the most interesting local corridos. They're all part of our own U.S. history. They deal with conflict, a lot of them, between Mexicans and gringos, you know. And one of my favorite phrases, since I didn't speak Spanish, I still don't, is los rinches cobardes. Comes up almost in every single corrido. It means the cowardly rangers. And I fell in love with that term when I heard that on a corrido. Esos rinches cobardes, you know, this, I thought, oh boy, this is a good one. This is the brave Mexican standing up to those rinches, you see. And so I just totally, and then I guess my background being of German background, somehow I'd never heard accordion music that had this much guts to it and spark. I mean, German accordion music is so sappy in contrast to this stuff. And these guys dance. When you see them dance, they got some spark behind them. And this is one of the many regional musics of Mexico. And in Mexico, they've never really paid much attention to it until these companies all started recording it here and being successful. And then they finally agreed, I guess we better listen to this hillbilly music, as they refer to it in Mexico City. They call it far-far music, isn't that right, Jim? That's what they call it. Far-far-far. In Monterrey, these people who think this is really awful stuff, because they prefer the boleros, you know, with just guitars or polite orchestras or string groups and so forth and so on. Anyway, so the success of this Ideal label brings us to another family a little bit further west in Mission, Texas. That's where he started. This is, I hope I'm not, am I running too way over? Okay, we're gonna cover four of these labels. This is a Falcone label. The number one. This is the first ad that appeared in the San Antonio Spanish paper.
Cuando miro el amor mío. Que tiene el alma más dura que ni las piedras del río.
A fairly nice voice, but again a house accordionist backing her. Pedro Ayala, yeah. The sound that he created was that alto saxophone mixing with the accordion. I call it the Monterrey sound. That's definitely from northern Mexico. It became hugely popular in the late 40s into the 50s, and still today. Los Tigres del Norte still make many records that has the sound of this blending of the alto sax and the accordion. This is Mr. Armando Ramirez. He's the owner, and he started it. He was more into high tone music, as they call it. His brother became a famous composer, and he lived in New York, and he told him all about, you know, how to make classy Latin music. But he knew where he lived and what the people there liked. They didn't
siempre
like Cuban music.
De amores, te haces but la
this is some more polite music from Mexico. The trios, still a big thing, very popular, boleros. Again, a much more typical orchestra of a local dance band, but with the accordion by Pedro Ayala. Tom, I really appreciate this. This is magnificent. This is cool. And then I had the fortune. Okay, let's go to this. This is on the back of a cancionero, those little songbooks they used to print. They're hard as hell to find. Okay, the great lady, I just visited with her yesterday morning. Yeah, Lydia Mendoza. She's still alive. She's in a nursing home, but she's as sharp as can be. And I played for her some of her old music, and she just beamed when she heard her father singing and the mother. Anyway, Falcone knew all about her because she was already a big name. She had recorded for Bluebird in the early 30s. She was on every label around. And so I once asked Mr. Ramirez, how did you run into Lydia Mendoza? And he said, Chris, I didn't run into her. I looked for her. I knew she was famous. And the first number he recorded with her became a huge hit. Now, I guess we didn't have it there, that one. But anyway, then this came along, Los Alegres de Terran. Mr. Ramirez didn't really like this music. This is pure from the ranchos. This is pure hillbilly music. This is the equivalent of the Stanley Brothers in bluegrass. But a lady who ran a record shop in Reynosa, just across the river from McAllen, she finally told Mr. Ramirez, listen, if you don't record these guys, I'll never buy another one of your damn Falcone records. And so he finally gave him an audition. But they had already become quite well known around Monterrey, and we're going to deal with that label in just a minute. Of course, they became monsters all over Spanish-speaking Americas. Los Alegres de Terán were the first monster conjunto. That means two singers with accordion and bajo sexto. And it was pure country music. They came from a little town called General Terán. It's just southeast, sort of east of Monterrey, Nuevo León. And they were started by a guy who ran a bus company between Tehran and Monterrey, and he apparently discovered, this is a long story, this is what's been intriguing me and Jim, this is why we just came back from Monterrey to try to find out the origins of this Norteño music, you see, because it was just starting at that time. The combination of the singers being heard on the radio and on jukeboxes with the accordion. The accordion used to be just known as a dance instrument in the ranchos, out in the fields, you see. But all of a sudden, on the jukeboxes on the radio, you could hear the voices blending with that. And boom, it all happened within a couple of years, roughly 47 to 49, I would say. And the man who ran this bus company, he had met Los Alegres de Tehran. He said, listen, I'll sponsor you on XCT. XCT, which was one of the big stations. They were already broadcasting some regional music, but not this accordion stuff. And they said, okay, if you pay for it, we'll put them on. And apparently they were very, very successful. And some people said it was done in response to the cantinas were complaining that their patrons would leave during a certain hour when they would listen to the radio station in Nuevo Laredo, where already that fellow Maya Icantú were broadcasting. They said, listen, we must have this goddamn hillbilly music here in Monterrey someplace, don't we? Let's put on our own people. And that's what happened. And he sponsored Los Alegres de Tehran on XCT. They became very successful. And a Mr., I think we're coming next to the Orfeo label. This is my holy grail. Okay, this is the first recording on that label. This is very typical of the traditional music of Nuevo León, two clarinets and a bass drum. That is still, you can still see him in the street sometimes. And Mr. Arioja, he had an exclusive monopoly on distributing records in Monterrey at this time. This is about 47. Okay, this is... This fellow Ortiz is Tomás Ortiz of Los Alegres de Tehran. This fellow Maldonado, he was trying him out as a second singer. And they made this amazing version. You can again talk to Mr. Nicolopoulos afterwards. They did this corrido, and it's in favor of the Agraristas. I hope I get this right. During the Mexican Revolution, you see, part of it was to break up the big landowners and to give the land to the peasants. This is in favor of the peasants. They later made a Nuevo Corrido when it became famous, which is in favor of the landowners. Because, you will find out, many conjuntos, once they get famous, they don't want to sing offensive corridos, depending on the audience. One of the instrumentals that they made. Because Mr. Arioja, as I said, he was a distributor in Monterrey of Ideal Records. They were pressed at the same time as they were here. He would send them over to Arioja and have them pressed there. And he knew he was making a lot of money. He said, well, hell, if this Texas music sells here, maybe our own might sell too. And so he pressed these almost exclusively for the jukeboxes in the cantinas. That's why they're so damn rare. They only pressed about 500 of each. And, well, we have a priceless letter. Do we have that one from? No, okay. Anyway, Mr. Marroquin, who was recording for the Ideal material, he wrote to his boss saying, listen, Mr. Arioja, he's got these Huracanes de Tehran, they're terrible, an imitation of the Alegres. Now he got some even worse ones, Los Hermanos Dominguez. There's no fidelity to them. Don't put this junk out. We have lots of good artists. You see, Mr. Betancourt in Brownsville, who was always keen to make a buck, he figured, well, maybe Arioja is going to send me something now that I can sell. But Marroquin said, don't mess with that junk from down there. Well, anyway, it's an amazing battle between these two little companies. Unfortunately, or maybe interestingly enough, Orfeo was stopped by a big company in Mexico, Orfeon, that has an N on it. And they were already established, and they apparently stopped the company from continuing. And so it didn't really last very long. Also, it's still a mystery as all the competing people involved, but Mr. Arioja apparently was a very nice person, and he loved this music and produced these strictly to satisfy the cantina patrons, because very few high-class folks would buy this kind of record, you see. And also, they didn't have the money for it. There was really very little of a market on the Mexican side for this kind of, for the low-class kind of music. I guess we better move on. I think. We're going on to Rio. Okay, well, this Orfeo label, I was just in Monterrey because my gopher, who has been trying to locate things for me from Eagle Pass, he found a collector in Monterrey who actually had 15 of these. And so I made a special trip down there to.
You brought back 10.
Well, I already got 4 of them before. Anyhow, they are sort of like Charlie Patton's, you know. And they were really made for a similar class of clientele. Of course, most of you will probably say, well, they don't sound all that interesting to me, but to me, they're the roots of this music on the other side. And that is hard to document unless you have the records, and hardly anybody would touch it down there. And okay, the last and final one, yeah, I think we're doing good, is a small company in San Antonio, Texas, that was begun by Mr. Jaime Wolf. And he was a businessman, but he apparently spoke Spanish. He was into fixing radios and electronics. He was also, I think, a pilot, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, he had all kinds of neat interests, and he thought this cantina music was really neat in San Antonio. And he realized that a lot of these musicians were at their best when they're half lit, you know, not totally sober like these big labels that started at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know. So he set up a little studio in the back room of his record shop, was the Rio record shop on West Commerce in San Antonio. And Flaco Jimenez happened to be one of the early recording artists that he got in there, and he told me, oh boy, we always had plenty to drink, and let's just listen to some of the Rio recordings. And also he had ear to not just the pure music that was from this region, but he also heard that they were mixing it with blues, with R&B, with, anyway. La ratita is the little rat. The accordion with saxophone, typical sound of this alto sax and the accordion. In this kid, a guy named Jesus Casiano. This is Mr. Wolf at his shop in 57. They covered the big hit for Los Alegres de Terran, Ojos de Pancha. They simply call it Pancha. This way they didn't have to pay royalties. Okay, they actually recorded some of the old-timers who were still around from the 20s and 30s. Pedro Rocha was one of the great corridistas, singers of corridos and other songs, recorded in the late 20s onwards, and he was still around, but had to have an accordion with him. The Rocha brothers. Like most musicians told me, Chris, by the 40s, if you didn't have an accordion with you, if you just came with those two guitars like in the old days, he said, nobody'd pay you. You got to have that accordion, just like the mariachis had to have a trumpet all of a sudden. They got hip to the pachuco boogies.
Una me quiere, otra me adora, y hasta me enferma con su mirada. Quiero a Lolita,
¿a quién más?
Amo a Julieta,
¡a mí, Gamo!
Me traen tan loco, con tanto amor, qué dolorcito, hay tanta bronca.
There you see my friend Clifton Chenier. Who originally made the song, and these guys were hip enough to, hey man, this is cool. This is R&B. That was the beginning of yet another underclass, not just the cantineros, but the pachuco kids, you know, who were just feeling very separate from the world. This is Flaco Jimenez's first recording group, Los Caminantes. It's the young Flaco when he was still Flaco, skinny. Accordion. An very informal agreement signed by Mr. Wolf and his artists. Always had witnesses and all that sort of thing. Well, I guess this brings me to the end of the Rio label. Gives you a little glimpse of four very different personalities involved. The first one was a jukebox operator who was into all kinds of, you know, the music around him, from the orchestras to the conjuntos, which you could compare, like in black music, from the lowest in those days, you would call it low class, like the blues, to Duke Ellington and so on, the orchestras, you know, and the boleros and so on, much more sophisticated, to Mr. Falcón, Mr. Ramirez at Falcón, who was really into the bolero, into Latin music, but he knew that in that area, the New York Latin music wasn't going to make it, and so he realized very quickly that he was going to record everything, at least what he considered respectable. And Pedro Ayala was a well-known accordionist who was, you know, okay. He wasn't just a beer garden musician. And then, of course, he found out that the stuff from the north, just directly off the ranchos, just out of the woods, was really getting popular, and he finally agreed to record some of that. And then he had Mr. Arioja down in Monterrey, who was a businessman, but he apparently also liked the music. He had his ears open. He figured, if these people in the beer joints love this music, I'll record it. Why not? And then to Mr. Wolf, who really enjoyed all kinds of things and partied with these guys. And we didn't play one of the real wild ones that I... Okay. Anyway, I hope it gives you some kind of feeling for four of the different labels, and of course they all played an important part because they documented the music pretty much unfazed. They left it pretty much the way the musicians and singers brought it to them. And so everything kind of blended. But I think I'll let you ask some questions. I mean, I can go on, as you well imagine, forever. And so I better not bore you to pieces. And see if there's anybody who... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My question is, with the website, you use the record labels. There's no copyright issues on that, even though you only use 60 seconds of the actual song?
On the UCLA website, in all the discussions that we've had, no one has ever brought that question up. So as far as I'm concerned, no, there's no problem at all. Yeah.
Were there a number of small labels too on the other side of the border in the California area?
You mean in California? Yes, there were some. Of course, they recorded primarily the music that came into California, which was more the Mexican, the mariachi and so forth. Yes, Los Angeles, and of course they recorded the Pachuco music. Lalo Guerrero became really well known for that. And of course Don Tosti, and who was a bass player, and he was really proud of being a great Chicano bass player with Jack Teagarden's orchestra. And now all of a sudden we approached him because he made the Pachuco Boogie. And he said, well, you know that junk I recall, we just had fun with it. But oh, he can't call that music. But it was the biggest hit he ever had, you see, that was. Yeah, right here. Oh, sure. Professor Nicolopoulos and I did a book on the Mendoza family some years ago. It's still, I think, available from the Arte Publico Press. Anyway, you can also find it on our website. We still have copies available. And, oh, yes, I mean, I try. In the old days, I didn't, you know, tape was expensive, and I just listened to people. That's really how I learned my history of it, because there were no books. Nothing was written on this material. Unfortunately, I'd never taped it because there were not even cassette machines. You know, once the cassette machines came in the 70s, I started to do some of it, and now I actually videotape a lot of people, and we're working hopefully on some kind of a publication that deals with the roots of this music on both sides of the border, with an emphasis on the corridos.
Let me say something about that. Mm-hmm. It is our desire to add those oral histories to the Frontera database. The whole idea of the Frontera database is not just to have a database of 78 RPM records, but to make a digital encyclopedia of this music. So hopefully when you click on a Lalo Guerrero, his name, you'll see maybe there's an interview or maybe there's a videotaped interview with him as well as that. The whole idea of a digital encyclopedia is that it's all accessible and easily found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any plans to digitize the
Mariachi
recordings that you did, like, from
Manuel Rejo? The entire, I know I'm emphasizing here this kind of regional northern music, you see, from the north. No, all of my Mexican records are being digitized, and the 78s include a lot of that. The beginnings of the mariachi is very interesting because we found out that the earliest was made in 1908 by this group called Cuarteto Coculense, basically two violinists and a guitarrón, which can't be heard on an acoustic recording. And the guitar, and so actually Kurt Naunk was the guy who had it once on an auction list. Usually I never look at cylinders, but somehow I happened to glance at his cylinders that he had on his auction list, and there was one by Cuarteto Coculense. I said, oh my God, even the discs are very hard to find, and I never thought I would ever find a cylinder. It was in mint condition on a blue amber. It was interesting that Cuarteto Coculense recorded the same 20 sones. Sones are a type of song, that are sones, abajenas, and so forth. They recorded the same repertoire for each of the three companies that went down there before the revolution, for Columbia, Victor, and for Mr. Edison. Apparently the competition of distributing was so fierce in those days that if one had a certain song, just like that darn thing by Mr. Dalhart, you know, that flying out of your prison, the prisoner song, yeah. Everybody wanted that, you see? So that's exactly what the Cuarteto Coculense did. They recorded the same 20 tunes for each of these guys because each of them thought they had better distribution than the other one. And then I found out about the Mariachi Marmolejo because my friend Johnny Clark happened to be a mariachi, and he worked in Mexico City, and he had encountered the son of Mr. Marmolejo, and all of a sudden he came up with this photograph, and I played him these records that I had. They were actually labeled as Mariachi de Coculense de Rodriguez, and I always thought, well, which one? There's a very elegant, in the picture, there's a very elegantly dressed gentleman sitting in front of this group of peasants in their white Mexican rural clothing, you know, and I figured, well, he must be the leader. We found out he was a patron. He was the guy who arranged for that mariachi to record for Victor when they returned finally after the revolution in 1926. By that time, they had electrical equipment. And, I mean, the gringos hightailed it out of Mexico when the revolution started because they didn't like to be shot at.
And they didn't return until 26. And so that's how it all came together. And he said, that's the Marmolejo mariachi. I said, well, let's put those out. And anyways. And yes, they're all being digitized, and we have also reissued some of it on CDs on my label.
Would that be on the UCLA website?
It already is. Yes, yes, those would all be there. Okay. I'm not sure if our CDs are there yet. No. No. You know, that's something we should really advertise, if that's possible. That's because we got to make a buck somehow out of this. That's a conflict of interest. Uh-oh. All right, no sales. Just contact us.